This podcast is an invitation to feel and experience the souls of famous old Hollywood homes and to have an in-depth journey to the areas where they're located through interviews with longtime residents. Either you're a fan of old Hollywood in Los Angeles, planning to have a vacation, or an even bigger step, considering a certain area for your future home, this is your opportunity to receive valuable information and insightful advice you won't find anywhere else.
Hello, hello, and welcome to my podcast. Are you in the mood for California? Today, we'll feel and experience Venice, California, featuring an interview with distinguished Nils Lambrecht.
Venice is truly, truly eclectic. It's probably the most eclectic place I have been living in. I come from Germany. I lived in many different places, but since the last 30 years, I'm in Venice. And Venice, when I came, was a truly, truly eclectic place in a sense that there were a lot of artists there. Artists which painted, artists which created their environments, their houses. The Venice canals are something very special, I think, because it really was for many years a focus point of artists moving there and living there and creating art. And that really attracted me in the very beginning to buy a house there.
Masha Korpacheva is a California-based realtor and a member of the National Association of Realtors in Los Angeles. She's an advocate for selling and buying homes with soul and practicing mindfulness in real estate. With master's degrees in spiritual psychology and linguistics, Masha brings all of her skills to work with her clients. An intuit and empath, she has touched many lives with her outstanding ability to see beyond the visible and helping to come to better understanding of issues and their resolutions. An adventurous world traveler, from climbing Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania to exploring the Galapagos Islands, Masha has a particular passion for the City of Angels. Having landed in this paradise and adopted it as her home, she's been sharing old Hollywood stories since 2007. In the mood for California, feel the soul of old Hollywood.
And now, are you ready to experience Venice? In the early 1900s, a strange dream took root on the windswept dunes of Southern California. It was the vision of one man, Abbot Guinea, a wealthy tobacco magnate with a wild imagination and an artist's heart. He didn't see marshland and scrub brush. He saw gondolas, canals, Renaissance architecture, and a new kind of utopia. And he would call it Venice of America. But no great dream is ever built alone. While Guinea's name would become synonymous with this improbable seaside resort, the soul of the story belongs equally to a man history almost overlooked, Irving Tabor, a black teenager from Louisiana who came to California chasing the promise of something better. Tabor arrived in Venice around 1909, just 17 years old, with very little to his name. He found work sweeping the old Venice Pier, then a raucous place of carousels, pleasure rides, and boardwalk entertainment. Venice, in its earliest years, was more than just an imitation of its Italian namesake. It was a carnival of life, a kaleidoscope of visitors, vaudeville, and visionary architecture. The canals, dug by hand and crisscrossed by arched bridges, shimmered with promise. Somehow, in this fantasy world being constructed on the edge of the Pacific, Tabor and Guinea found each other. No one knows exactly what drew Guinea to the quiet, hardworking young man. Guinea was already in his 60s, a well-traveled eccentric who claimed to have worked for President Ulysses S. Grant and had spent time studying European cities. Tabor, in contrast, was navigating the constraints of being black in early 20th century America. Yet, within a year, he went from sweeping floors to being Guinea's personal chauffeur, assistant, and, though no one would have called it that then, trusted friend. They drove together across California in a Model T Ford, winding through undeveloped lands and wilderness. Keeney would talk for hours about nature, about the future, and sometimes, Tabor recalled, he would say nothing at all, letting the quiet stretch on as if he were listening to the land itself. Tabor was there through it all. The parties, the celebrities, the strange and brilliant plans. Mary Pickford came to visit. So did Babe Ruth. Fatty Arbuckle made appearances. But through the glamour, the constant was this unlikely bond between two men society tried to keep in separate worlds. In 1920, Abbot Keeney died, his dream still half-formed. Much of the infrastructure of Venice was deteriorating, the salt air eating away at the wooden pilings and plaster facades. The city was beginning to change. And before Keeney passed, he made one final and deeply personal gesture. He left his home, an 8-room, 2-story house near the canals, to Irving Tabor. It was an extraordinary gift, but it came with a cruel catch. At the time, Venice's canal neighborhoods were governed by racially restrictive covenants. Black families weren't allowed to live there. So even though Keeney had left the house to Tabor, the law said he couldn't reside in it. Tabor, however, was no stranger to making the impossible happen. With characteristic ingenuity, he split the house in half. Piece by piece, he floated it. Yes, floated it. Down the very canals he had once been barred from calling home. It was a slow and symbolic journey, ending in Oakwood, a neighborhood that had become a safe haven for Venice's Black community. There, he reassembled it on Santa Clara Avenue, and finally, the house became his. That same house, with its grand fireplaces, wrought iron railings, and leather-lined dining room, became not only a home, but a monument. In 2008, it was designated a historic cultural monument by the City of Los Angeles, not just for the men who built it, but for the men who moved it. Irving Tabor lived in that home for decades. He founded a maintenance company, worked as a bank guard, and became the unofficial oral historian of Venice. Until his death at age 93, he told and retold the stories of Abbot Keeney, the wild early years of Venice, and his own role in a dream that didn't always welcome him, but one he helped shape nonetheless. Oakwood, where Tabor made his home, remains a crucial part of Black history in Venice. Though waves of gentrification have transformed the area, its roots run deep. Tabor's home still stands, quiet and dignified, holding memories of gondolas, big ideas, and friendship that defined the odds. As for Abbot Keeney, some of his canals survive too, a ghostly reminder of a fantasy once real. And if you ever walk along them on a quiet morning, look closely. You might still catch the ripple of a dream floating by. And here we are. Welcome to Venice. I'm so thrilled to have Nils Lambrecht here with me. Dr. Nils Lambrecht, MD, PhD, is a distinguished clinician scientist, professor of pathology, and accomplished medical educator, with over 25 years of experience in clinical practice, teaching, and translational research. Based in Southern California, he serves as a surgical pathologist at the VA Hospital in Long Beach and is the Associate Dean of Curricular Affairs at the American University of Health Sciences. Dr. Lambrecht's expertise spans endocrinology, gastroenterology, and molecular biology, with a research portfolio that includes 45-plus peer-reviewed publications and international presentations. Deeply committed to advancing medicine in undeserved communities, he is leading the development of an accelerated community-oriented medical curriculum that integrates basic science, clinical excellence, and humanistic care. In addition to his scientific and academic work, Dr. Lambrecht is a devoted father and passionate photographer, drawing inspiration from the vibrant energy, creative spirit, and ever-changing coastal light of Venice, California, a place he proudly calls home. Today, he is offering a personal glimpse into what it truly feels like to live there. Hello, Niels.
Hello, Masha.
Oh my God, what a joy it is for me to have you as my guest on the podcast in the Mood for California. It's the first time I will be speaking to someone about this magical place, Venice.
Yes.
So you live in Venice, in California, so we're not talking about Italy, and it's one of the most eclectic and soulful places in Los Angeles. So what is it actually like to live there? And how would you describe Venice to someone who has never set foot on its boardwalk or walked its canals?
You captured just one word in your question, which is eclectic. Venice is truly, truly eclectic. It's probably the most eclectic place I have been living in. I come from Germany. I lived in many different places, but since the last 30 years, I'm in Venice. And Venice, when I came, was a truly, truly eclectic place in a sense that there were a lot of artists there. Artists which painted, artists which created their environments, their houses. The Venice canals are something very special, I think, because it really was for many years a focus point of artists moving there and living there and creating art. And that really attracted me in the very beginning to buy a house there. But when I came, Venice had just awoken. It was a very poor place at the time. It is not what it is now, 30 years later. Mm-hmm. It is like a very expensive place to live. At the time, it was very cheap to buy a house. And the house I bought, when I bought it, I told my parents, which have to give me the down payment, I said, this is like a shack on the beach. And basically, many, many houses around the canals in Venice proper were shacks on the beach. It was 800 square foot, you can imagine. Yeah. But it always had these really wonderful people living there. They had all, you know, one of the things I did when I walked the canals in the beginning, I was thinking, man, nobody on the side of the water where the walkways are is actually having any curtains, because all the curtains were always open or they didn't have any curtains. And you could always look in their kitchens and their living rooms, and there was all this beautiful paintings and artwork and sculptures. And it's still like this. There is this kind of effort of everybody to show the beauty of their homes inside.
Yes.
And they don't really close them all up with curtains and privacy and high walls like what you have in other areas of the city. And that attracted me. And this is also what I show when people come visiting me from Europe and from elsewhere in the world. I always take them and they're so amazed how open and inviting houses are and these kind of open, you know, looking through window experience you have when you walk the canals.
Very true. Wow. It tells you that the community where you live, the community of Venice, is very open-hearted. People do not try to be private and kind of like shut down and not show what's inside. They're just sharing what they have. This is very unique.
It is. It is. It is a very unique experience. And it makes this place very special, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
Even so that I think because of gentrification, there is, we fight for maintaining this. We basically want to be this way. We don't want to close our windows and build big mansions with large walls and privacy. We want to stay the way we are. And I hope that Venice can keep this character because that's what makes it special.
Yes, 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 I can see that. And as you mentioned, that's so true that Venice has long been a haven for artists and seekers and visionaries. And you are a scientist and a photographer at the same time. So what actually inspires you most about this neighborhood? Maybe there are some secret gems or places that you feel uniquely your own.
When you go at the sunset, which is in the west. The canals, which, you know, they're like a square. Mm-hmm. There are east-west ones and there are north-south ones. And the west one, east-west ones, they have this beautiful sunset down the water. And we have these bridges, west-east canals, and you can make these wonderful photos. And we have birds there. We have egrets, mm-hmm. and we have lots of ducks and other birds. And it's really beautiful. Sometimes people walk on along the sides of the houses. And then in the evening, when the sun goes down, you have this beautiful light. And you have already like lights on in the living room of the houses. And it's just very pretty. Mm-hmm. And I really like that. As a scientist, I have to say that Venice was really changed in the 90s, because a lot of scientists from UCLA, in which I was working for 10 years, moved in this area. Mm-hmm. So that raised the quality of life a little bit, because we did have good income and we could buy houses and we could actually make our houses more beautiful. So there was some influx of educated people, which really enjoyed the artists and the artistry we could see and also supported as, you know, new citizens in this area of the mm-hmm. city.
Hmm. Very interesting. So in a big way, it's not the area that influenced you, but you influenced the area, you know, making it a better place.
That's probably always like this. There's always a counter-transference, I think, one calls this, mm-hmm. where you influence the place you live in has influenced you to come there. Mm-hmm. And Venice is actually really, I think, a good example of that. That's why it's so eclectic, because there's a lot of influence, a lot of different people, a lot of different cultures. Everybody's so signing up for having open windows, showing their artwork, showing their beauty of their houses and showing and keeping the Venice canals what they are today.
Yes, yes. And I strongly believe that as humans, the place where we live, the actual structure, and also the area that we choose to live in, and the city, as in our case, Los Angeles, really, really deeply affects us, who we are or who we are to become, because there is this interesting interplay as to where and how we live, and different facets of our personalities show up and express themselves. Isn't it fascinating?
It's fascinating. I want to add a little bit something which isn't actually in the question, but one of the things we brought to the canals that we kind of wanted to build a very interesting house when we finally had enough money to rebuild our house. And we built this house in a sense of, or in a dream of, Hundertwasser architecture.
Yes.
Our house has all kinds of elements which reflect that. Hundertwasser was a very organic architect, which had beautiful colors. And we really created much of it, not all, but much of it, and created a house which is quite interesting. Mm-hmm. And when you go around Venice, this is what makes Venice Venice too, that each house is different. They're not the same. When Abbot Kinney built them, mm-hmm. they're all the same. Now there is so much difference from each house to house, big ones, small ones, different designs, different styles. You have Italian styles, you have like Spanish style, you have like New England style. Everything is there. And that makes it, for me personally, very interesting.
Yes, yes. And for me, it's the essence of Los Angeles. And it sounds like this is the essence of Venice, that everybody can be who they are, and everybody is accepted, and this all-inclusive environment allows you to be truly free.
Yes.
Wow, that's so beautiful.
Agree.
So, Nils, could you please share, how do you find balance between your scientific work and your creative life? Does being a father maybe help you shape the way you see the world and capture it through your lens?
That is a very interesting question. I actually have always been in between being creative. I played the piano. When I was a young person, I was in a conservatory in East Germany, and I wanted to be a conductor and composer.
Wow.
And so I wrote some classic pieces of music. I was very, very lucky to live in a city, Leipzig, which has a beautiful orchestra, Philharmonic Orchestra. I saw the big famous pianists, violinists, and orchestras of the world. And that was what I wanted to do. But then, like life is always, there was some beauty in my biology class. and I had a great teacher. And from that, I fell into studying medicine, believe it or not. I was 17 and I changed my entire plan.
Wow.
So I've always been in between. I still like to play the piano, like to play music, guitar and things like that. But of course, my life has changed because I had to be a father. So when I became a father, I really had to focus on providing. And when you provide, some of the things like the creativity sometimes slows down a little.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm in the end of my career as a physician and scientist, and I'm looking forward to retire.
Mm.
Forward to do all the creative things I have put aside, and which are projects which I want to do but never had the time. You can't make music if you don't have peace in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think you really have to have peace in mind and find that time. And I'm also very satisfied with my career as a doctor and scientist because I met many good friends, very nice people, and it allowed me also to provide for my family the way I did.
Yes, yes. And it sounds like in your retirement, you will not be bored even like a single moment because you already have a plan and you sound very inspired. And, you know, having purpose, no matter how old you are, is, I think, the most important thing in life. And you can fully step into your creativity when you retire. It sounds just absolutely marvelous.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. And that's why I'm also not worried about retiring.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so waiting for it.
That's an inspiration. You are an inspiration, Nils. So you have dedicated your life to medicine, research, and teaching. You have taught in prestigious institutions like UCLA and UCI, and now help to create new fast-track medical curriculum at the American University of Health Sciences to teach medical students from medically undeserved communities to become family practitioners or primary care providers in their own communities. So what do you believe the next generation of doctors needs most, not just academically, but as human beings entrusted with care?
It's a very, very dear to my heart question, or dear to my heart also thing I want to bring into medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Medical doctors have become such specialists and such people which are not really completely connected to their patients.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a very good system in the United States to have general practitioners. Practitioners, you know, your house doctor, the doctor who knows you, who knows your husband or wife, your family, and your kids, and who just watches you from time to time and realizes when there are stresses coming, when there are changes in health coming, and how to pick that up early on, and preventative medicine can happen that way. So to me, we need to have focus on this family medicine care providers.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that in the United States, we have a vast, it is one of the least frequented residencies, family practice medicine.
Mm.
And we have not enough. It is very difficult to get a general practitioner. And most people go right away to specialists. And specialists are not really involved in how you feel. They're not really doing general screening procedures. So we need to have people who know you in your community who can be providing this care, this kind of family care. And when I started, you know, I was basically pulled in there from an old colleague. My old chief of staff wanted me to do this with him. He got this new project at that small university. And we sat there and created this curriculum specifically to get most students going to this medical school to become family practitioners and primary care providers.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to have students, medical students coming in, which came from these really poor neighborhoods. The universities in Signal Hill, which is a very underserved community, very poor community. And from there, we wanted to have people coming in. They get a fast track 3-year program after they had done their medical school in 3 years. And then they need a 1.5-2 year family practice residency. And then they could come back into these communities and take care of all the people which live there from a standpoint of not making lots of money but from a standpoint, I came from here and now I'm giving back.
Mm-hmm.
That is basically what we try to do.
Mm. Wow. Very honorable. It's, you know, I could not agree more that when you go to the doctor, you almost like come to a healer, right? And healing only comes when there is human connection.
Yes.
And if they just prescribe you medicine and they tell you you need to do this and that, but they do not know you, they do not see you as a patient, then you're basically left alone in a way to deal with whatever disease you're dealing with. And in your case, teaching doctors to be more human and to establish these connections with their patients, I think it's the most important, the most honorable thing that one doctor can teach another doctor to be.
Yes, that's the dream.
Yes.
Realities, though, are quite difficult because medical school is still a very expensive undertaking and family practice is the least paid for profession in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always this disconnect from young people, young doctors, to keep them in that dream instead of just running off to become a surgeon, ophthalmologist, or the other highly paid specialties.
Yes.
So it's not easy. And that's why we have to do this systematically in the medical school so that we could entice people which come from those areas to understand that that would be a life worth living.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that will be a true purpose, not just to make money, but to really be a good human being.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I really hope your dream will come true.
Right.
Very special. No, it's very special. And I hope it will become a reality one day. And so, Nils, my last question to you. You have worked in pathology, endocrinology, gastroenterology, molecular biology, and much more. Are there any patterns, maybe truths or lessons that you have seen across these specialties that you think we all as people should understand about health, healing, or being alive?
So when you look through that list, what you just mentioned, it comes from very small to very big.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets like from the small cells to the pathology of the body.
Yes.
And what I think the lessons I learned the most is, no matter how small or how big you go, the body needs whole health. The entire thing is all dependent on each other. So we have to make sure that people live as a whole organism in a healthy environment. Actually, it goes further than just for one organism. We all have to live in groups, and we have to live in societies. And when the society is very healthy and there is not so much stress, people will be much more healthy and they don't get so many diseases. But when people are stressed and work too hard, then they get more diseases. So, and it goes for the individual the same way. If you as a person are able to relax and to be happy and to enjoy life, you will be staying healthy and get older. But if you're stressed out and you're running all the time, and you're living an unhealthy lifestyle for this or that reason, that will shorten your lifespan. Mm-hmm. It will increase the chance of getting diseases, especially cancer, very much dependent on stress.
Mm.
And external stressors. So I think the most important thing about health, healing, and being alive is we are organisms which need some peace, and we can't always just compete. When you compete, compete with yourself. Don't compete with others. Make the best you can do and who you are, and try to better yourself, and don't too much push other people aside and stress out and react to what happens around you.
Wow. Wow. What a great piece of advice. Compete only with yourself, because this is so true that if you compete with others, only then you get really stressed. But if you compete with yourself, you try to be better, but at the same time, you are relaxed and probably you actually achieve more.
Most of the time, that's what happens. So I try really to keep stressors low. But of course, sometimes stress is there, and some good stress, some push is good, but bad stress is not good.
So, Nils, what helps you the most to help not get stressed out? What helps you the most to relax?
Well, right now, it's my family. I had difficult times, but I'm really, really in a very good place right now. My kids are grown. I have a wonderful wife. I'm really, really happy with my life. I have a dog. I walk the dog every day, and we walk him together. We talk together while we're walking. It is a really great and very peaceful time in my life, which makes me being actually much more relaxed and healthy than I used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
So that really, I have to say, when the family or where you live with your intimate relationships are good, this makes a huge difference. Another thing is that work environment is very, very important. I think if you can manage, but it's not really dependent on you all the time. But when you're lucky enough that your work environment is one which is more peaceful and more oriented on getting tasks done than putting other people down or stresses at work we usually have, if your supervisor and your boss is nice, and if you can be nice to the people you lead, this environment is very, very important for you too.
Mm-hmm.
So have this peace at work, you have this peace at home. And then when any other stress comes, financially or not, so you kind of more resilient and more relaxed.
Right, right. And plus, you have something to look forward to, your retirement. And when you will fully step into your creativity and live with purpose and with your family and continue to enjoy life.
Exactly. So my parents, my sisters in Europe, in Germany, they all retired when they were 65 years old. My dad died when he was 95. So 30 years of beautiful retirement. My sisters are in their 70s, beautiful retirement. They enjoy their grandchildren. They travel a lot. And none in our family was worried or afraid of getting retired. We were mm-hmm. all going for it. And so I keep that retirement age for myself.
Wow, that's great. That's great. Well, Nils, thank you so much for such a warm, insightful, and just wonderful conversation. And to hear the things that you shared as such a renowned doctor, you know, it meant a lot to me, and I'm sure it will mean a lot to our listeners. And I'm wishing you all the very best to continue what you're doing with your life and let your dream come true that, you know, the future generation of primary physicians will be more human and focused on human connection, and let your life be stress-free for the many, many more years to come.
Wonderful, Masha. It was a pleasure to talk to you and sharing some of my thoughts, and I hope people will enjoy it.
I hope the same. And yes, and Venice, it continues to inspire so many different people, and thank you for making it a better place with your presence.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Until next time. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much for tuning in to Feel and Experience Venice with my special guest, Nils Lambrecht. If you enjoy my podcast, In the Mood for California, please sign up for future episodes at your preferred platform, and please leave your feedback. I really appreciate your time and support. You can also follow me on Instagram at In the Mood for California and check out my website www.inthemoodforcalifornia.com. Next time, we'll wander into Little City Farm, a hidden sanctuary where imagination takes root and everyday life feels a little more grounded, a little more magical. It's a place where the scent of rosemary drifts through the air. Chickens roam under fruit trees, and creativity grows alongside vegetables in raised beds. Here, time slows just enough for intention to rise, and the ordinary becomes quietly extraordinary. And all of this right in the middle of Los Angeles. I just can't wait to see you there.
In the Mood for California, feel the soul of Old Hollywood.